I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh.
Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley, and this is the Golster Magazine Show and podcast at the later evening hour because my guest is across the Atlantic Ocean in Canada, where winter is beginning to grip, as it is here, and where she is going to open our eyes to a myriad of her loves, her missions, and her stories. She is a soprano soloist, and she will sing for us, and a song. You could request it. Let's see what happens. She is a wildlife activist, and we're going to hear stories about saving animals and want to hear yours too. We've all come across a wounded bird or a four-legged lovely at some stage. She is a poet, and she has just published her first novel. And before I say any more, welcome Angela van Bremen to the Golster Magazine Show.
Well, thank you so very much for that lovely introduction. And it's such a true delight to be here joining you.
Now we're all in the middle of a bleak midwinter here. The headline news is terrible over here in Britain. So your job, Angela, is to lift our spirits tonight. So I have to ask you, where are you right at the moment?
I am located in a rural area north of Toronto in Ontario, Canada. And the place is called Loreto.
Loreto. And is it hilly? Is it jungly? Is it flat?
It's actually called the Rolling Hills of Adjula Township. That's the township that I live in specifically. So it has a lot of gentle hills and valleys. It's quite pretty. It's very beautiful. There's rivers that run through it. And it's a lovely area to live in.
And have you been there all your life?
Absolutely, I have. I grew up here, went to school here. Went to school at Adjula Central, and then north of that, when I went to high school, I went to Banting Memorial High School, and Banting is the discoverer of insula.
And you've never had this, because you're so adventurous in your creativity, you never had a dream to go and live in Tahiti or Nepal or somewhere.
No, I haven't had a dream to live anywhere else permanently, but we do love the warmer climes, of course, as we all do, because winter can really wear down on one. And so my husband and I do go to Costa Rica quite frequently. It's warm, it's beautiful, it's in a rural area as well, so that we can enjoy the tropical rainforest. So yes, I love the warm weather. I don't like the cold weather, but when it's spring, summer, and fall here, it's absolutely exquisite, and I can't think of anywhere else in the world.
That's lovely. Costa Rica is your sanctuary getaway. I want to talk, we've got a lot to get through. I want to talk firstly about your wildlife, because you're the founder of and a big player in wildlife charities. And I want to hear from the audience too, because we've all got stories about saving something. But Angela, tell us firstly, what are the animals that are in danger and how do you look after them?
First of all, I'm not a founder of an organization called Procyon Wildlife. I have been with them since 2016, and I was invited to be a director in 2020. And so the way I have been exposed to wildlife living in the country for all these years, I've always been very much aware of wildlife. And as habitat is lost, more and more interactions are happening between human beings and wildlife, to the extent that we're getting more injuries to humans at times, and also needless deaths to animals because they are interacting with humans, being evicted from what used to be a forest, now from an attic. And really their loss of habitat means they have no place to go. So an interesting story, in 2016, I was visiting a friend of ours, and he has an antique shop called The Past Glories of Toad Hollow. And in the early days, he would overwinter cars in this large warehouse space. And then as soon as it was May 1st, he would have everyone take their cars because they're going to drive them for the summer. And it was mainly British car collectors. I belong to a car club called the Headwaters British Car Club. And so we got all our cars out that day, and he started to set up his antique shop for the summer months. And there was this little black Eastern gray squirrel. And I call them black because although the species is called Eastern gray squirrel, they come in different colors. They'll come in black or the beautiful gray color for which they're known. And so this little tiny creature was coming up to me and obviously was hungry and orphaned. My theory is that maybe the rest of the family was in a nest that got driven away in one of the British cars. And so he was the only one left. And I called Procyon Wildlife and I said, what do I do? There's this orphan squirrel and I'm sure he's lost. And I think he's separated from his mother because I had read that they don't usually approach human beings or even other creatures unless they're desperate for food and shelter and warmth. And she said, yes, that's absolutely right. And they couldn't take on any more animals at that point because the center, we only accept as many animals as we have volunteers to care for them. Mm-hmm. But she says, look, I'll give you some training. I will set you up as a foster. And as soon as we have room at the center, then you can bring the squirrel to the center then to rehabilitate and socialize with squirrels his age. So this little squirrel was called Sammy the squirrel. And so that was my first interaction with Procyon Wildlife. I was so fascinated with them and I approached them after we had successfully released our squirrel, little Sammy, with two buddies named Colin and Elmer.
I just have to say, you said he had to meet squirrels of his age, his peer group. So how old was Sammy?
Sammy was probably about, he had fur, his eyes were open, so he wasn't what they call a pinky, but Sammy was probably about 3.5 to 4 weeks old. And so we do need to have squirrels in the same age group. Obviously, if you have one which is a bit more, is older and more rambunctious, he can't be with a younger squirrel.
How old was Sammy when you released him out into the wilds again?
About 10 to 12 weeks old is when they get typically released. So the system is that they are cared for around the clock. If they're found, like say a nest falls out of a tree or someone traps the mother, and now they find later on a nest of baby squirrels. And so in that particular case, they are fed every 4 hours. They're weighed to make sure that the right amount of formula is given to them. And they are stimulated along their belly to make sure that they have their proper movements because that's important. So they mimic sort of the things that a mother squirrel would do for her baby. And once the eyes start to open and the fur starts to grow, then that's always a great sign that we're doing a good job. And eventually they get very rambunctious. They get to be squirrels with their own little personalities. When they're old enough, they go into outdoor enclosures so that they can acclimatize to the weather, the different elements that they would be exposed to in nature. And we have these wonderful volunteers who build these squirrel boxes for us. And they're roughly about 2 feet high and maybe about 1.5 feet wide. And that's their nest. So they learn in their outdoor enclosures to start living in this nest. And then when they're ready for release, volunteers will get all of the squirrels because we have tried to put litters together because they learn from each other. That's part of that socializing.
All meaning hundreds or dozens?
Four or five would be normal in a litter. Yeah. And so then we get them into their nest, and then we tape it over with, we have a mesh on the outside and then tape that over securely around the edges. And then we transport them in the wooden box. And then one of the bravest people in the group then will take a ladder, climb up and fasten the box to a tree in the forest. We pull off, obviously, the opening. So that they can leave when they like, and then that becomes their home in the woods. Now, some stay and use that as their home base. Others end up leaving almost immediately and creating their own natural nests with leaves high up in the trees. So
And they would be just a few months old at this stage, would they?
Well, they would only be around 12 weeks old, maybe. So not very old, but old enough. They're adults at this stage.
Now,
a couple of litters at least in a season of squirrels.
Now, you being in Canada, we're thinking, or I'm thinking, grizzly bears and, you know, crocodiles and wild horses and that. Do you do any of anything like that?
You're wondering if we do exotic things. Well, really, basically, because we're in southern Ontario, we don't rehabilitate bears. We don't rehabilitate moose. They're further north. They're more in northern Ontario in our particular province.
Yeah.
But we do rehabilitate white-tailed deer, the odd coyote, a lot of beautiful foxes. They're susceptible to mange. And again, that's partly because of their loss of habitat. They are getting closer to humans, where people are maybe throwing food under the feeders or food that's falling from under the feeders, and they're getting more susceptible to getting diseases from other animals as well. But mange is a particularly bad one, which is a mite that crawls underneath the skin, and eventually the poor animals can't see. Their skin gets very crusty and their eyes crust over, and yet they still can survive for such a long time because of their keen sense of smell that they don't lose. They'll eat roadkill and they'll basically survive practically blind. And at that stage, it's a bit easier to catch them. We have live traps, which we put food inside the traps. And then, of course, once we're able to capture them, it can be about a 5 to 6 week treatment plan. And after that, they are completely healed and they're beautiful coats again, nice bright eyes. And then we release the foxes. So that's we do a lot of those. One animal that is not exactly exotic, but relatively new to Ontario over the last 30 years, with our climate change occurring, is the Virginia opossum, which used to be basically just in the U.S., but they had pretty much established themselves as a strong population in Ontario and other provinces. And unfortunately, because they have such little fur, they're very susceptible to frostbite. So the tips of their ears will get frostbitten, their tails will get frostbitten. And for the first time ever, we have over 30 opossum in our care that will be overwintering this year.
How big is an opossum?
Not terribly big, maybe. A large cat, maybe.
Yeah.
Not enormously large.
And they're wild, aren't they? They're
wild.
Yeah, so always wild.
Yes. So the reason why they came to Ontario is they were hitching rides on, you know, maybe on a transport truck that's coming from Florida, perhaps. And mm-hmm. so the population ended up coming further north. And so this is an unusual animal in the sense that 30 years ago, we would not have been seeing a marsupial, and they're marsupials. North America's only marsupial, and we wouldn't have seen them 30 years ago, but now they're quite a frequent sight, and we love having them because they eat ticks. They can eat up to 1,000 ticks a day, which is phenomenal.
And these are the ticks, so you get in the burrow under skin.
Correct. They can cause Lyme disease, which is absolutely horrible. So, they're a beneficial animal to be part of our ecosystem now.
And I just have to envisage that. Then I want to get back to the foxes. I'm sorry, we're probably spending far too long on wildlife, but it's fascinating. If anybody wants to move on to poetry and novels, just put it in the chat. But give me an image of how a possum eats a tick. I mean, where is the tick when it eats it? And does it suck it up or bite it, or is it like a McDonald's? I mean, how does it all work?
Watched an opossum eat a tick, because the opossums we watch eat, they essentially are being cared for us, so we have to give them different kind of food. But we're not able to order a package of ticks to tell. but you know, for example, if I'm gardening outside, then This past spring, when I was outside in my garden, I got one on my forearm just by pulling leaves away. So you'll find them in branches. You'll find them in dead leaves. Like, that's where you'll basically find them. So you really have to be cognizant. It's not a problem we used to have as much as we do now. Is so many ticks, but basically you just have to sort of check yourself over at the end of your gardening day to make sure that none is attached to you.
So Tammy says, my limited experience of Canadian squirrels is that they are ingenious at stealing bird food in gardens.
These are the animals you're saving,
are they?
Yes. But I don't mind, because they're all part of the ecosystem, because you know what, we hate to think of it, but the other part of it is balance and life. So squirrels are food. Essentially, they're food for our foxes, they're food for our coyotes, in other carnivores. So honestly, I mean, you have to sort of understand that as much as we love and like to rehabilitate, we also do not interfere with the
ecosystem,
and source of the food chain. Exactly. But to touch on about the squirrels, we have a very clever squirrel at our house at the moment. And this particular squirrel, we did some trimming, and because we noticed that he was able to jump from one of the higher trees in the maple tree, higher branches, and he lands on the roof, and then he proceeds to crawl in underneath and eat the bird seed. And so originally he wasn't doing that as much, and he was crawling up the pole and sort of crawling up around this, what I thought was a rather clever device, a sort of a disc underneath the feeder. That didn't work. Then I found something that is like a long tube, and it's maybe about 10 inches in diameter, and it fits, and it wobbles, and it fits underneath the feeder attached to the pole. And so the raccoons and squirrels, when they try and climb the pole, they can't do it because it's unstable. It just wobbles back and forth. So we thought, that is going to fix the problem with all the animals going into the bird feeder. Well, this squirrel has devised a way of climbing up the branches, and he at the flimsiest of branches, and he jumps down onto the top of the roof, like I described. And, you know, there's a point where you think that ingenuity, you almost don't want to discourage it anymore, because if you're that smart, you may as well enjoy it. That they're clever, they are intelligent, and very amusing. Entertaining during the winter months when there isn't much to do except look out the window.
Rebecca loves what you're doing. And she loves Sammy, and she asks a question which is going to come to me shortly. Monkeys, what do monkeys eat off each other in line? That's also like ticks. Would you know?
I know that they do groom themselves, and I'm not really well versed on monkeys. Can monkeys hear? But I think it's fleas, if I'm not mistaken. But definitely, they do groom each other, and they will take off any pests that don't belong.
Okay. And have you heard about, Rebecca here, have you heard about squirrels, one on the Mission Impossible theme on the assault course? A squirrel became very famous. Is that right, Rebecca? Yeah. Squirrel. And just before we go off the wildlife, the foxes here in Britain, our cities now are where the foxes find their food, and they're everywhere in the cities. Is that the same as in Canada?
Unfortunately, as Toronto grows, I was rather distressed to read the other day that our highway 401 in Toronto is the busiest highway in the world now. It actually, I think Los Angeles is second to it now. So that gives you an idea of the busyness. And rather than looking for the right type of housing, they're just moving more and more into the countryside and carving that up instead.
Yeah.
Rather than having a proper plan. And so you're seeing pockets of small villages and towns really starting to explode with subdivisions.
Okay.
So where there was before forest and natural habitat for all our Ontario wildlife, they're being displaced, which is why we also see fox an awful lot in urban settings. All animals, even coyotes, fox, the squirrels we were talking about playfully before, now are trying to make homes in attics when before they would have had a nice rooftop, house. So that's something I think the whole world is facing, habitat loss, and it's a really serious issue.
And did you ever have fox hunting in Canada like we had here? It's now banned, but did it ever?
Yes.
Is it banned there as well, or?
No, I think it's frowned upon. I think it's banned now, but I don't know 100% sure. But there's a place called Caledon, just about 20 minutes to the south of where I live, and they would do fox hunts, definitely.
Okay.
And that's still within recent memory. But a lot of people now are advocating, more and more people are advocating for wildlife. And the cruelty of the fox hunt is just an unbearable thought to many people now, and it's really frowned on. Is it done on some rural properties privately? Possibly. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that.
And Sue mentions bears also venture into towns now looking for food. That's right, Sue, because up in northern Canada, British Columbia, they do have that problem in town. You have to have pepper spray with you.
Actually, it's same place, Caledon, last year, had a cub, a black bear cub, wander in. So he came from the north for some reason and migrated a fair bit south. And so it was a beautiful endeavor between the Ministry of Natural Resources and a vet from the National Wildlife Center. And they were able to tranquilize the bear and then move him to a more suitable location. So, yes, it happens to us too, but it's a rare situation. But you do hear about it maybe once in a while.
Thank you, sir. That is our wildlife section of our show, but everything is interlinked. You are also a poet.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us, is it interlinked, or does your poetry come from a different section of your creative brain?
I would say that almost everything I do is linked to my love for wildlife and for nature. And I really wouldn't even know how to separate that, because it really is part of the fiber of my soul, of who I am. So all these things are quite interrelated for me.
And how old were you when you wrote your first poem?
Oh, I was about 10 years old.
Can you remember the lines of it?
Dawn cannot be far long. And I can tell you that I have since modified that poem significantly as I've gotten older, but, all families have arguments and disagreements. And so my parents were having one day when I was about 10 years old, and I was so unsure about how I could stop this, because it was not a normal thing in our household for them to argue at all. And so I remember going upstairs to my bedroom and sitting behind my little desk, and I wrote a poem. And when I showed them that poem, it wasn't very long, it was just a few lines. And I went back down and I thought, well, maybe words can ease this somehow. I thought maybe there's something to do with words would make them stop, you know, this discordance. And I showed the poem to my mom, and then she showed it to my dad, and they both just gave me this enormous hug, as if realizing, you know, what was going on and what was happening. And it taught me an important lesson about how important the power of words really are. And so that's my first memory of a poem.
Can you remember the whole poem? I know we decided we sort of discuss this, but I didn't know this one. I'd love to hear this one.
I don't know.
You don't know.
It the way it was originally, because I modified it so very much. But I do have my book of poetry here, and I may just be able to find. I think it's on page 40.
Okay. But whilst you're looking for it. What is poetry exactly?
For me?
Yeah. for all of us?
Well, I think poetry is the most powerful way of expressing how you view the world, how you feel, what you observe, your emotional state. And put simply, for me, poetry is painting with words.
Okay. And it's different to writing a straightforward prose sentence?
I used to think that, but when I started writing my novel, I began to realize that there was a cadence and rhythm to my writing in much the way there is when I'm singing or when I'm writing poetry. And that was something that I was not expecting to happen, but I realized that there's this rhythm, there's this cadence that comes with any kind of writing, or for that matter, any kind of creativity. I think there's a rhythm. I think there's a natural energy that if you're willing and open to tap into it, then you can definitely find that zone. And if you can find that zone, then people who are reading your work, or if it's a visual piece of work, then they're going to look at that or read it or listen, and they are going to be immersed into what you are feeling as well, because they'll feel that rhythm too. And I think that that is when a work can be beautiful, and that's what I hope to attain with any projects I encounter.
And before I ask you to read the...
If you can't find it, though.
If you can find it. Well, you're going to read something else, if not. But the poetry and the lyric for a song, because we're going to move on to that. Is that more creative or more expressive than just write, because it has a discipline to it? Because it has to... I'm not talking about iambic pentameter or Shakespearean verse or anything, but there is a discipline, isn't there?
There's a discipline, and if you're musical and or schooled in poetry, you'll know that you're missing that cadence. If you have an extra syllable, you'll stumble just reading it aloud. And they even suggest, no matter what type of work that you write, read it out loud, because your ear will hear. And you will naturally stumble as well if there is something that doesn't fit with the cadence. That would be the best way that I could think of explaining it.
Okay. Read us something. Tell us what it is.
They read it and then tell you, or just have you just read it?
Is this your 10-year-old poem?
No, I can't find it.
You can't find it. So
I wasn't prepared
then just read it and tell us.
All right, since we were talking about nature and climate change a little bit, I'm going to read you something that is called But It Is Not Spring. And it's called Gaia's Sorrow. Sadness flows through my day, looking for the brightness in the gray. Creatures in deep slumber are awakened by unnatural warmth, bewildered, searching for food and their mates, longing for spring sunshine when the gentle flowers of spring rise again. But it is not yet spring. But this to come forth, the winter winds and snows are needed. No heavy winter snow to insulate our gentle sleepers and protect the seeds waiting to grow. Warnings to halt, global warning, remain unheeded. Mankind jokes, we can use the warmth. Skip that miserable cold season, but it is not cold and it is not yet spring. Mother Nature is baffled and her creatures confused, waking and mating too soon. And no place to go as forests are denuded and waterways polluted. Gaia's temper tantrums grow worse. Fierce storms of epic proportion. She no longer speaks to us, but screams. What have you done to our home? I gave you everything you needed, and still you do not listen. But it is not cold, and it is not yet spring. The sensitive morn, the once blue and green, we interfered with God's design, all four seasons needed for us to be. We must embrace winter's icy hand, feel spring's gentle benediction, and the lazy days of summer's heat and autumn's colorful farewell.
And before I say anything, tell us the message.
The message is that as much as we can enjoy milder winters, it's not natural, and it is a reflection of the changes that are happening. And it is natural, and we should want to embrace all four seasons. Mm. They have beauty each season, and there's a reason by nature's design to have those four seasons for all to flourish.
And when did you write that, and what was the catalyst that made you sit down and write it, and how long did it take you?
It's a fairly recent poem within the last several years, as I have observed on the news more and more of these drastic, dreadful storms that seem to hammer all parts of the world. And so that was really part of the inspiration for this particular poem. How long does it take me to write a poem?
Yeah.
I have to tell you, not very long. It takes me, I keep my iPhone close by, because the words come almost right away, and I can't write them as quickly, so I dictate them. And then afterwards, I obviously need to tweak and make sure that that cadence I spoke about and that the rhythm is there properly. But poetry comes fairly naturally, and it comes quite quickly. If it's there, it's almost if it's written for me in a way, almost like automatic writing, but I know that it is still coming from me.
So did you say on this one or others, do you wake up with a poem in your head?
Sometimes I do, yes. Or I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'll have something that's partially formed. And if I like the idea and it's not a full poem, then I'll just make sure that I record what I do have. And then I may not do something with it right away, but pretty soon, you know, when you let your subconscious relax and you just let your mind go quiet, quite often in a little while without expecting it, you'll get the rest of the idea to come together. And I find that happens with my writing for my book as well.
And we're going to get onto the book in a minute, but we're sort of progressing through, because you've got the poetry there from when you were 10 and you caused a reunion and broken argument of your parents, which was a very touching story. And then and you also write the lyrics for your music. Is that a different process than the poetry? Or do you, because Rebecca has said, say, well, there's a message from Rebecca which prompted this question. Thank you, Rebecca. I was excited to hear you create songs from your poetry. I do that also. Oh, we should get Rebecca on with this. But
really, the two are so intertwined. However, there's three songs that I have on the album In the Breeze, and they're Celtic inspired. But the first song was literally a poem only. And a very good friend of mine who's a musician, when she read the poem, she said, "This is so beautiful." She wrote a piece for me for that particular one. Mm-hmm. And it's called I Will Be in the Breeze, which is the inspiration for the title of the album. It's very contemporary and avant-garde, and I absolutely love what she did with the piece, because she really, she's had me use all parts of my voice, which is fantastic. The second
So you wrote the lyrics, is it? And she did the music.
I wrote the music for this particular one.
And in all of them like that?
No, the second original piece on the album is called Do You Hear the Drums? And this is a rather amusing story with a very good friend who has a successful painting business in Orangeville, Ontario, which is not far from where we live. But he's also a musician. And recently he started playing the handpan drum. And that's a little bit like a steel drum, but it looks also a lot like a UFO that sits on your lap. And anyway, it's quite an amazing instrument. And he said, while he was doing some work, the work needed to dry. And he says, "You have to hear my new instrument. I'm so excited." And he started playing this instrument. And I, right away, I had lyrics and I had the music to go with what he was, you know, with his drumming, what he was playing, I had it instantly. And so we worked on that song for about a year to perfect it. And it's called Do You Hear the Drums? And that is with Casey Cole playing the handpan drum for me. So I'm open to all different types, like it, wherever it comes from. So if it's written for me because of friends inspired, that's great. Sometimes it comes from me. The third song is a sea shanty, and this is a rather fun story too. I believe that all writers should belong to writing groups. And the writing group that I belong to is called the Wordsmiths, and they're located in Alliston, which is to the north of me. And during COVID, we met by Zoom, as all of us did, of course. And they always would provide writing prompts. And one was to write about the sea. And I got so excited. I thought, oh, I'm going to write a sea shanty. So I wrote a sea shanty, and I was intending just to write the words for it. But as I was writing it, it just came to me as I was writing it. So I could hear the melody as I was writing the lyrics down.
Okay.
So, and quite often when I'm walking in the forest, I'll be singing something and the music is just coming along with it. So that's what happens usually.
You said something a little back there I think the second song took you a year to perfect.
Yes.
So you said it just that you can write a poem in a day, practically, or less than a day, and then a year to perfect that. What are you doing in that year?
Well, it was the music part. It was making the arrangements that Casey was developing, making them work the way we wanted them to. And when we went to the studio and Mars Giamarco from Red Egg Studio produced the album for me, and he had Casey come in and record. And so it turned out that to make the song make more sense, we needed another verse in there, which I happily wrote. So that one was a little bit different, but the essence of it came almost immediately to me when he first started playing. But it needed refinement with the way that Casey was doing the different chords.
And do you, because if you're working on it and doing it again, do you hear it so often that you know that you can't tell whether it's good or bad?
I know when, about getting too close to a project.
Yeah.
You're asking. No, I know that when I know what I want, and if it's not working, then I'll just keep working at it. So it's not that I get so close to it, but I used to oil paint when I was younger. So what you say has a lot of relevance, though, because there's always that danger of putting that one last dab of paint in.
That's right. And never being happy that I know.
Sure that you did that because it could be catastrophic.
Now, this is your chance that you've told us about the three songs. I want you to give us a little bit of one of them. Sing us the song.
Okay. I'm going to do the one that's the avant-garde one that my friend wrote for me.
Okay.
There is no pain like any other when it's time to say goodbye. Mother, father, sister, brother, together our weighted hearts will sigh. How do we bid farewell to our friend so hard to accept the end? As we see the life force flow away, feeling helpless to stop this pain, wondering when shall we see them again? Yes.
That is amazing. Goodness.
Thank
you. Now, that was incredible. And I just have to tell our wonderful audience that Ben and Angela worked very hard so that Zoom could take your higher notes.
So, would it come through okay?
It came through okay for me.
That's what she's doing. Yay for that. Thank you.
That was brilliant. And I have a question, but Rebecca has it too. How do you produce professionally into an album? Because, I mean, that was just you, no accompaniment in your top room or whatever it is in your house, and it sounded brilliant. But how do you perfect it into an album?
Well, I worked very closely with Mars Giammarco from Red Egg Studio so that I was in a proper sound booth with a proper recording material. The tracks were worked on ahead of time so that I could listen to the tracks to sing to it. I chose this song because it was originally designed to have very minimal accompaniment. And even on the album, it's very, very simple accompaniment. And I thought that that would be probably the most suitable to sing for something like this. But yeah, there's a lot of work involved to have them properly mastered. And you need to work with a professional who really knows sound.
But I mean, that was Rebecca says my 7-year-old was trying to sing along with you.
Oh, bless! Oh, how sweet! Isn't that charming?
We've got a one. What a voice, says Emma. We've got a big heart, fantastic, an amazing voice, says Sue. Thank you for sharing it with us. Yes, thank you for sharing that with us. That was an honor.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. That really makes my heart warm.
It was a sort of choral, almost Gregorian chant and a bit of, you know, church stuff, and everything was there, wasn't it? And am I right?
Yes, you're right. It's my friend, she's quite remarkable with how she wrote this piece, and I can't imagine it being sung any differently than what she wrote to these particular lyrics. And The poem was me working in the garden, and I was feeling sad about missing my mother. And so that's where the inspiration for the poem came from. And when she read it, she came up with this, and I was like, wow, like, because it requires quite a big range with my voice. And and she wrote it for that reason that way.
I mean, it was fun. I just put somewhere in the in the chat, the where you can listen to that album on Apple Music or something. But I'm going to put it in there again because that's the title track, isn't it? That
the album is called In the Breeze, and this song is called I Will Be in the Breeze, which is kind of reminding myself that even though my mom is gone, she's still there in the breeze. She's near me. She's the wind touching my face is like her caress. So that's the message from the song.
Goodness, that was missing your mother. And Emma says, that was amazing indeed. You sound like an opera singer even more than that. I would say that too, because you're more than just a soprano singing Turandot, aren't you?
Oh, thank you.
But you have got another treat for us at the end.
Yes, I do. I have something that I think you'll like very much. And In a recognition of our upcoming Christmas period. So, yes.
That's going to be beautiful. But, and so we have not got much time, I just think, because we have to sing. But we've had just a beautiful hour of chit chat and foxes and songs and poetry. And now we're going to fiction writing. And you have just published your first novel called Past Lives Revenge. Before you tell us about the novel, tell us what it was like publishing, you know, writing it, putting it together and getting it out there.
It's an interesting story. My husband is also a writer, and he published his first book in 2023. And I had started this particular book in my mid-20s. And I abandoned it about a third of the way through because I felt that I was a poet and I didn't have the patience. I was working and had met my husband-to-be. And so I just abandoned it. I forgot all about it. But I never threw the manuscript away. And once a year or so, I would be cleaning out my drawer and then I'd see the manuscript there. And I was always that close to just throwing it away. And then something always stopped me and I put it back in the drawer. And a little bit of my husband's inspiration for having written his book that particular year, so that would have been 2022, between Christmas and New Year's, he was just about to publish the following year, I found my manuscript and I said, well, why don't you read it at least? Well, instead of just saying nah and dismissing it every single year after year, why don't you at least read it? And I started to read it and I thought, well, I changed this and I changed that. And I don't really like what I did here because that's antiquated, because it's not modern enough now to my tastes. And then I thought, well, if you're going to have that attitude, then why don't you just rewrite it? So I started to write. And by the early January, I had rewritten the first part entirely. And then I sort of meditated and I thought, okay, now you're in a pickle because you were using that as a template. What are you going to do now, Angela? And so what I did was I mapped out the second and the third part. And so I had a plan. I had a focus on where I wanted the story, how I wanted to unfold and how I wanted it to end. And I was finished writing it by the end of May. And I shared it with a few beta readers, which I think is always important to get an idea of what they thought of the book. Did it have merit? And I got a lot of encouragement and I had it professionally edited. But I had a bit of a breathing period because they say that after you finish writing a piece, put it to the side and then look at it later. And so that's exactly what I did because I was ready in 2023 in July. I went into the recording studio for about 5-6 months for
the album. Go for In the Breeze.
Give for In the Breeze. Yeah. And so that was good actually because it gave me that cooling off period for the book. But then earlier this year, I went back at the book with, one more edit. I just felt I needed one more professional edit to make sure it was in good shape. And then I self-published it. And so I'm quite excited with the reviews I've been getting. And it was just something I had to do. I had unfinished business with that old curling up manuscript. It needed to be written.
Well, that's inspiration for anybody that's got an old manuscript in the thing. They do, when they changed the BBC offices many years ago, apparently the movers found about 2/3 of the people there had manuscripts in their drawers.
Oh, wow. So there you go.
Yes, you are not. But now encapsulate for you, because I found this thing very high concept, what you're writing about. So just give us that nub.
Absolutely. So, there's a young man by the name of David Harris, and he's had debilitating nightmares his entire life. Cannot find out why, has sought professional help from medical profession, no results, no relief. And so he meets by chance, but really it's fate, a young lady by the name of Emma Jackson. And Emma is a burgeoning psychic. And she suggests that he undergo a past life regression from a friend of hers by the name of Anna Tungsten. And as a result of the past life regression, he learns that he was murdered in his most recent life. And because his death was so traumatic, he reincarnated right away. And as a result of a little bit of detecting, he realizes that his killer is actually still alive. So then the novel focuses on David's, does David want to accept closure, knowing what happened, and that's his explanation for the dreams. And once he does know what happened, those dreams do go away. But now he's left with this burning desire to seek justice, to apprehend the killer before the killer kills again.
So this is an assumption that we are, I mean, does the whole of your society there believe in reincarnation, or is this just a one-off within a normal society, or are they Buddhists, or how does that work?
I would think that the fabric of our society would not be all that different than in the UK. I think most people don't believe in reincarnation. I do, however, us and others do as well. But and so it's commonly believed, perhaps in other countries more than some. But for me, I was exposed to a lot of psychics around the dinner table when I was growing up. My parents were always having intense discussions about reincarnation and about spiritualism. And so I grew up very comfortable with the concept. And I always had this fun idea, what if someone reincarnated, and what if they learned that they had been murdered in their most recent life? And what if they reincarnated so soon they learned the killer is still alive? What would they do? So,
and your personal belief in reincarnation, is it the sort of reincarnation that you've written about here, or is it more that the sort of thing that you can get reincarnated as a fox or as a mosquito or something? Give us an idea of that.
There's different ideas that you evolve from the lower life lower creatures and then go higher and higher. Some people don't think that happens at all. I don't know the answer. No one really does. So that's something that you have to contemplate on yourself to make a decision on whether you believe in the concept at all. And do you sort of extend continually until finally you've learned those life lessons that you were meant to learn? And for me, reincarnation is more about that. Trying to do better each time, trying to
The better life you live, better is the wrong word, but you get the fuller, better life that you lead now, then you get reincarnated at a higher level.
Correct, yes. Life.
And that is all under the judgment of a higher being or a god.
Or you just ascend enough that you no longer need to reincarnate anymore, and you ascend to the point where you just become pure energy. And you become one with God or a higher intelligence or who knows? I mean, we don't know. We don't know.
You don't. And is in your own personal belief, is that wrapped in a particular religion or is it just very personal?
No, just very personal for me and just the way I grew
up. And your parents, was that very personal for them too?
It was personal for them, but they evolved into it because my mother was a Catholic and my father was a Protestant. So... but they evolved into thinking this way. And I guess as a youngster, I just took on what they believed, which is not an uncommon thing.
That Catholic Protestant, that wasn't what the argument was about, was it, when you were 10?
No. But if we had more time, I would tell you all about the things that used to go on in a township I live in, because half was the lower half was Irish Protestant and the other top half was Irish Catholic.
Oh, my goodness.
This particular municipality, but that's for another time, perhaps.
A very quick last one from Emma before. Where did the idea of reincarnation come from? I think you've told us had any inclination towards your real life experiences. And then, do you believe in reincarnation? Yes. Do you suspect you are now or you were reincarnated, and from what?
Yes, I think I was, and I don't know from what. And the reason is I don't want to know. And that might sound strange, but I believe that we are given the tools and resources to live this life to our best ability, to take these challenges on. And I think that if I learned I don't want to cheat. Do you know what it's like? It's like looking at the back of the book and reading the last page rather than trying to live this life for the fullest. So for me, I prefer not to know. I was offered a past life regression, and about 10 minutes into it, I sat up and I said, I'm not supposed to know about my previous lifetime. I'm supposed to live this lifetime to the fullest, to the best of my ability. So that's okay. I hope that answers that.
I think that answers it for me. Sit there for a second, Angela, and dust off your vocal cords, but I'm going to tell people coming up on December the 10th, I am with Eva Hamilton. She is the founder of Key for Life. She is a friend of King Charles, a mentor of Richard Branson, and she's deeply into helping the underprivileged. Key for Life concentrates on young prisoners, keep them out of prison once they've been released, and she does it with horses. Horses. Angela, is that a wildlife thing that...
It's not a wildlife thing, but I am very familiar with this concept. I have a friend who actually does that kind of therapy here in Ontario, and it really benefits people. It calms them. There's something about the horses that are just so calm and so loving and nurturing, and it really seems to help people a lot with who are mentally distressed. And so I can well imagine that there would be great success with helping young men rehabilitate and return to a lovely, healthy, and happy life outside of prison. So I think it's wonderful work.
Fantastic. I'm going to send you the link to Eva's show, in case, although you won't be up in time, but you can watch it on a podcast. December the 17th, I'm with the sporting superior Mihir Bose, journalist, writer, reflections on migration, race, and British society since the 1960s. That's when he came here. And he made history because he became the BBC's first non-white sports editor. Editor, I think, in all of the editors. December the 23rd, it is Christmas Eve, and we are not going to have a show unless you really want one, in which case tell us and we will get Angela back or something like that. And December the 31st is New Year's Eve, and Lucinda has on her party dress for Claire McIntosh's The Last Party. That is a village murder mystery. And oh yes, it's on New Year's Eve. Angela, we've had a fantastic time with you. Will you come back?
Yes.
We can talk about foxes and reincarnation and novel writing and all sorts of things.
Absolutely. I'd love to. It would be a delight. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Rebecca is following you on Facebook, TikTok, and I think a few other things that I've lost in the messages, but everybody, a lot of messages coming through. Time's Winged Chariot is upon us. We're going to have a song at the end of this, but until next week with Eva Hamilton and her prison horses, stay curious, keep active, be generous, be empathetic, and love our animals, as Angela does. And of course, stay Goldster. Check out the podcasts of past guests just by Googling Goldster Podcast. An array of beautiful conversations will unfold in front of you. Tell your friends and enemies and sing our message long, high, and loud. And talking of singing, we've talked about it. We're going to break with tradition, and we're going to ask the wonderful Angela to sing us out and goodbye. But first, thank you, Angela. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, absolutely.
What are you going to sing for us?
Cantique de Noël.
Thank you. Take it away. What an incredible and inspiring and lovely guest you've been.
Thank you. Minuit chrétien, c'est l'heure solennelle où l'homme Dieu descendit jusqu'à nous. Pour effacer la tâche originelle et de son père arrêter le courroux, le monde entier tressaille et espérance en cette nuit qui lui donne sauveur.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Everybody's clapping. The messages are coming in.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
and now we have to say goodbye, but we will meet again.
I would love to. That would be so much fun. So delightful to meet all of you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Goldster Magazine Show podcast. Check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by Googling Goldster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and hope you're with us again soon.